Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, our old friend Ed Calderon joins us for the second half. He tells us all about what's going on in Mexico. Tiller Russell's a filmmaker, made a very interesting four-part doc series about a DEA agent who was killed by Mexicans or the cartels, or did the CIA know about it? Well, we're going to find out all about that. And also some crazy stuff about what would happen if you flew a helicopter over a poppy field in Mexico. First, I'll tell you about BetOnline. No shortage of action with our exclusive partner, BetOnline.ag. MLB's in full swing. NBA, well, the playoffs have started. They're up and running. Plus, UFC, boxing, NASCAR, and soccer. BetOnline has the best odds and lines for upcoming games and matches. Need more? BetOnline has simulated NFL, NBA, and UFC daily. Also, hundreds of live casino games, poker tournaments, best props in the business as well. So sports is getting up and running, man. Let's get going. Let's have some fun. Football season is right around the corner. Visit betonline.ag, our exclusive partner, Podcast One. Don't forget, use the promo code Podcast One and sign up for your bonus and do it today. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts.
In the spirit of Murrow, Jennings, Cronkite, here's another great moment in local news.
Pricey protection, the face mask that will set you back more than $1 million.
That's a great moment in local news. Now, back to the Adam Carolla Show.
Well, Ed Calderon has joined us. You know Ed Calderon. You love Ed Calderon. He tells us everything that's going on south of the border and bleeding into this country as well. He's an ex-federale in Tijuana and now makes his home in the United States, but has many insiders and gets all the information, what's going on over there. Always good to see you, Ed.
Good to be back. Not a former federale, by the way.
Oh,
former agent of the government. That's what it was.
Oh, they don't call them federales over there?
Oh, that's a bad word.
Is it?
Yeah, right now it is.
Oh.
Right now it is. It used to be cool. It's not anymore.
I want to know the distinction there. Sorry, and we'll try to figure that out. Tiller Russell is a director. He's got a four-part series, docuseries, The Last Narc. It's available on Prime Video right now, and I guess it's Amazon Prime, right?
Indeed.
And they just call it Prime Video, or they go Amazon Prime. Now, I'm all over the place today. But Amazon Prime Video, and I have not seen it. I was talking to Mike August about it, and he said it's mind-blowing. He said, especially the end and what... When you really find out the story, what happened to a DEA agent, Enrique Kike Camarena, so from 1985. So let's get into that, because Mike was saying, oh, they found the guy still alive. You know, talk to people like it's. Let's do the sort of elevator pitch of the story, and then we'll get into some deeper, nuanced discussion about it.
Well, essentially, it's a four-part series about the most notorious murder in the history of the DEA, which was the kidnapping, torture, and murder of Kike Camarena in 1985, and the sort of shadow of dark alliances that surrounded what happened to him and why. And so it's our deep dive on exploring the truth behind the legend.
So people are familiar with the case, and he was tortured, he was killed, and... I think the big revelation is that we knew about it and we were aware of it and even there as well, meaning agents from our government. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was a kind of a shadowy alliance of Mexican cartel figures, people from American intelligence agencies, both the DEA and the CIA, and sort of with the apparent complicity of the governments on both sides of the border.
What was, Ed might know this the best in this conversation, what was their main product in 85?
It was two things. The growing of amapola, which is basically, they started growing, they had poppy fields down there, and weed. pot feels. They mention in the documentary the famous Rancho El Bufalo, which some say led to the bringing about the anger of the cartels when it was found after Hakeem Camarena's investigations.
So it was heroin and weed were the two?
Amapola, which is poppy fields, and weed was being grown in the hillsides. And they were basically moving cocaine up into the U.S. That was kind of the main business back then for the inception of these. I mean, these were the OG cartel members back then.
So let's tell the story of Kiki. Where does he start off, and does his arc work?
Well, there's two intertwining stories, right, in the course of the series. One is the story of Kiki Camarena and sort of what he went through as he ascended the ranks at DEA and became kind of a, you know, legendary guy on the streets, door kicker, first through the door kind of person who was working in Guadalajara, Mexico. And then at the time of his kidnapping and murder, it became kind of an international sensation, a news story in which you know, people were trying to get to the bottom of what it was. Later on, the second piece of the story is that the investigation several years later was taken over by a man named Hector Boreas, who sort of came from a similar background, didn't necessarily know Kiki, you know, on the streets and working, but was deeply moved by his story and willing to go to the end of the earth to find out what really happened.
And you're a former crime reporter for newspapers, so that you kind of have your base there. I mean, you know how to investigate things.
I've spent the bulk of my professional life knocking around, you know, either cops or criminals or gangsters, sort of since I first began working. And for whatever reason, I've kind of gotten a passport to that world, and on both sides of the sometimes thin and porous line between the two. And this for me was kind of a culmination of, you know, 20 years worth of time in that world and the story that I had kind of waited patiently to tell, actually for about 14 years, if you can believe it.
So why would they torture and kill this agent, Kiki?
Well, this is a deep conspiracy, and by conspiracy, I don't mean conspiracy theory. And the nature of any given conspiracy is it's a sort of incredibly dark tunnel that you go deep into. And so our goal was just kind of to bring a little bit of light into the tunnel. And the kind of initial telling of it was, hey, there was big, you know, dope busts down there and sort of marijuana fields that were burned up, and Kiki was being kidnapped and tortured in reprisal for that. But, you know, what our story uncovers, and that's by dealing with like firsthand, first person witnesses, participants. I mean, you literally have in the series the actual one of the men who laid his hands on Kiki, you know, put the gun in his ribs, stuck him into the car, brought him to the house where it was, put him in there, was involved in tying him up, blindfolding him. And what unfolds in the course of the telling of the story is it wasn't a simple kind of, you know, revenge of the narcos, so to speak, but that there was concern that Kiki had stumbled across the kind of dark alliance of drug cartels and the CIA affiliated with the Iran-Contra scandal. And everybody was afraid that the whistle was going to get blown.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk in the 80s about the CIA bringing, you know, crack cocaine to the inner city, and obviously there was a lot of Iran-Contra stuff, and there was a lot of discussion about the CIA. It's weird, you don't really hear much about it anymore, but there was a lot of like dirty CIA talk, and it was always unclear whether they're doing this or they're not doing it. I just kind of assume they're doing half of it. But so the belief, Ed, I'll ask you, where do you come down in the conspiracy theory department?
I mean, to me, I got to work with some of the old school guys that were active back then. And the stories around this are, you know, it's a legend down there. And the stories down there range all over the place. CIA involvement has always been something spoken of in circles down there since the massacre at Tlatelolco back in '68. It was a student uprising that was quelled by the government down there. It turns out the president of Mexico was actually on the CIA payroll back then. And they were hunting for communists back then. Then you move forward to what happened to Kiki. What we heard, well, like what I heard when I was coming up, is that the CIA was using drug running and smuggling to fund the procurement of arms that were then sent back down south. That was kind of the gist of some of the stuff that was happening back then.
For the Contras and the Sandinistas? Okay. So, first off, here's an interesting thing that was just running through my head. I always ask Ed these questions. I don't know if they're answerable, but you go back to 1985, you go to Mexico, and you go to the cartels. And now we fast forward 35 years later to 2020. Is it better, worse, or the same? If you were to kind of say, you give it a percentage, or it's like, in L.A., in 1925, the air was good, and in 1974, the air was bad, but in 2020, the air's better. You know, so you can go, well, it's better, it's not perfect, but it's better, or it's going this way, or it's going that way. If you were to try to kind of designate a direction to this, how would you answer that?
I think you can trace a line from this event and some of the arrests that came out of it. That started the initial fragmentation of some of these criminal groups down there, which basically turned it into a worse problem. A few high level guys were arrested after this. Some say they were just used as scapegoats or as a symbolic arrest. That the true people that actually were responsible for it are still out there. But you have people like Felix Gallardo, Don Neto, Rafael Caro Quintero, which were the original. You kind of the guys that formed the Guadalajara cartel. They were, you know, arrested. A lot of these people are these three people are actually still alive. Two of them are under house arrest, well in their 90s, and one of them is out. And there's a $20 million bounty on his head by the FBI. But you can trace back some of the initial fracturing. It used to be there was one big major cartel down there. That was in control of everything. Now you have the New Generation Cartel, the Sinaloa Cartel. You have smaller cartel groups numbering in, depending on who you ask, 40 to 50 small groups out there, and they're all warring each other and the government. And the federal government is fighting with the state governments at times. I mean, if you look at just numbers, it's way worse now.
Awesome.
Can I add, Adam, that, yeah. You know, just building on what Ed said, like to me and why this story is still so relevant is like this is the flashpoint that has led to the cartel wars that have engulfed Mexico in violence to this day. Without this one specific murder, the kind of ultra violence and chaos and fighting factions that Ed was talking about, it's all directly a product of this one story.
Well, as I was talking about it with Mike August, he was explaining that one of the fellas who was there, still around, and I think living in Florida somewhere, maybe Miami, I can't remember what Mike told me.
The intelligence, the CIA Cuban, El Cubano, as they call him down there.
Yeah, you
can speak to it.
And the allegations are that you know that these people, firsthand, first person witnesses, are saying that not only was this guy kind of a notorious CIA asset, and the guy who, in fact, once upon a time had hunted down and killed Che Guevara and cut off his hands as proof of who he was, and was kind of like the zealot, you know, of the American intelligence covert ops effort was in fact the man who was one of the primary interrogators of Kiki and is the one that's asking many of the most trenchant questions on the, you know, recordings that were made of the kidnapping and torture.
Oh, and he's still with us and living in Florida somewhere, and nobody is looking into, I mean, what's his status?
Well, you know, it was interesting. Part of the process of like when these explosive allegations came to light, we took it upon ourselves to reach out to everybody who was directly implicated. And it had to be sort of very specific, like it's this person that says you were exactly here on these dates and these pre-abduction meetings where you were planning it. You were there on the day. You were the one conducting questions. You were the one who brought in the tape recorder because the entire thing was tape recorded. And so I had to go to him and sort of write him a personal letter saying, hey, here's what I have come across, what these other people have said. How do you want to respond? And he was very short and very sort of curt and said, this is all the product of a Cuban intelligence disinformation campaign. I was never even in Mexico during these years, and I have no further comment and don't want to be in the show.
Wow. What do you think, where are we at now in terms of our government, vis-a-vis the CIA, involved with these kinds of extramarital affairs? Again, I heard all about it in the 80s. I don't hear about it that much now. That doesn't mean it's not happening. Do we know what it's like now?
It's a great question. I mean, like one of the interesting things about the way the CIA operates and sort of that, covert shadowy intelligence operates is it all happens in the shadows. It's not like it's, a little cabal of people in a room and there's a clear chain of command. And what you have is independent operators, fully empowered, who are doing things as cutouts behind enemy lines. And that's actually the job of the CIA, right? That's what it was created for. But, finding an ability to like police that and making sure that people don't sort of run amok and abuse the power or deliberately being used to do it. Oftentimes it takes a long time for the story to come out. So my experience as a filmmaker and journalist, I guess, is that oftentimes you got to let these stories breathe for a long time. And then suddenly as people get older and they're like, they got like pressure on their heart about like what was the truth that they're carrying with them that they don't want to go to the grave in. That's when you kind of hear these stories. So it's like I think they'll increasingly come out more and more with the passage of time. And I imagine they're working all over the world. That's their job.
You can see 2006 era Afghanistan's production of heroin at an all time high, and that's at the peak of the invasion.
Right.
So that gives you. A pause. Also, Felix Gallardo, Don Neto, Rafael Caro Quintero, the three guys that were implicated and arrested for the murder of Kiki down in Mexico, none of them were ever extradited to the United States. And as far as I know, two of them are under house arrest right now, and one of them is still out there. And he was let go on a technicality after 28 years of being in prison, Rafael Caro Quintero.
So you're saying that if the CIA really wanted to bring this guy to trial with reporters and stenographers, they may have been able to do it, but they weren't interested in that?
It's suspicious to anybody that sees these three people of that and the crime they were implicated in and them never being extradited. You see extraditions happening every year, high-level ones. You have El Chapo, you have Alvaro Palma, you have all these guys that were captured down there, and then we extradite them. These three were never extradited. Also, you see the technicality that Rafael Caro Quintero was let go by. Basically, a judge ruled his trial as being he was tried federally, and he committed no federal crime, really.
So it seems suspicious.
So 28 years, they found this technicality, let him go. As soon as he was let go, the U.S. issued a warrant for his arrest, and they put a $20 million bounty on his head.
I have a question for both of you that's a little off this subject, but germane. So, Tiller, I know you were you directed The 7-5, which is another great documentary about basically the world's most corrupt, dirtiest cop out of New York City. I saw it on Amazon Prime as well. Where did I see that one?
I think that was on Netflix.
And Netflix. Yeah, it's a few years old. But you guys both know what bad cops look like, what bad police departments look like, and you've seen extreme examples of it south of the border, but also in New York City. You turn on the news, everyone's talking about reimagining policing and bad cops and this, that, and the other. There's always going to be bad cops, but could we ever really do it at the level that it was done in the past, or it is done now in Mexico? I mean, you know, there was something like, we want to defund and we got to reimagine. We need oversight. Could you even pull that off? Like, if you lived in Seattle now and you were just the bad lieutenant, you're just Harvey Keitel. Like, everyone's got a body camera on, and there's a Ring doorbell thing everywhere. Like, is that still going on?
Could you get away with it? Could you be the Michael Dowd of 2020? Is that your question, Adam?
Yeah. Like, how does that work? I feel like I don't know. Maybe I'm being naive.
No, I mean, I think it's a really good question, because, like, in every era, you've got the, like, perfect storm of circumstances that allow the crimes to happen. So for, like, Michael Dowd in the mid-90s, you had a flood of dope on the streets. You had, you know, massive amounts of cash. You didn't have everybody with social media and cell phones and whatever. So these guys were kicking down doors and walking into dope stash houses, and nobody was looking, and they just scooped it up and, you know, out they went, or eventually became bodyguards and whatever. But, you know, obviously now it is so radically changed, and Ed, I'm sure, would know better than I, but my instinct is you have these examples of, like, system failure all the time, whatever the circumstances are. Maybe it's, you know, dark web going on, you know, what's happening on the dark web in 2020, but there's always going to be people that are crooks carrying a badge.
Yeah. I just mean, could you do it the way you did it before?
I'll add this. When I was active, of course, corruption was everywhere, and I was active for 12 years, and still to this day, I still speak to some of the people that I used to work with. Body cameras are becoming a thing down there.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, and everybody is a potential camera now. Security cameras are pretty cheap, you know, so even in the third world, people have Nest cameras or Wi-Fi enabled cameras, so it's not as easy to kick in a door and steal, you know, a drug load or money, stuff like that. The phenomenon down there is this. Some of the lower level individuals, so the people that are working on the streets, are becoming a bit more dependent on the trickle down effect. So the cartels will pay the higher ups, mm-hmm. which don't hand any cameras around them, right? And the higher ups will actually have a payroll and pay the guys at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the form that the corruption takes. In most cases, it's no longer them going out there and stripping loads off people and reselling them.
Right.
It's higher ups trickling down the money that's paid for each of them to be loyal to the owner, which is, you know, that's what they call them, el dueño, who could be whatever cartel. On the U.S. side, what's the federal law enforcement agency with the most convictions for corruption?
What is?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I don't know, but it seems like Chicago's always number one for these sorts of things.
The Customs and Border Protection.
Oh, I'm not picking a city. I'm picking a job. Oh, so the folks, I mean, how can you avoid being paid off? I mean, and them not buy. How can you take people who make what a school teacher makes and have them police a group of billionaires and expect them not to take bribes? It's fundamentally flawed. I mean,
everybody has a price, and sometimes that, you know, they call plata o plomo, the silver or lead,
right?
And everybody has a amount of silver, or everybody that I know is allergic to lead.
You're talking about, like, essentially the equivalent of a multi-billion dollar corporation that's willing to do whatever is possible to, like, you know, protect those profits. So if that's, you know, butchering people, having high level electronic surveillance equipment, whatever it is, you know, you have to think that the powers that be, you know, are equally matched with the, you know, with the criminal element.
Well, you know, you just look at us and, you know, I'm not this dude, but Nike, Apple, you know, they got these shops in China. People are not treated humanely over there. A lot of putting the nets up because people are jumping off the top of the building, committing suicide and stuff. And what I'm saying is it sounds like I'm knocking Apple or Nike or whatever. Maybe I am. But I'm just saying the human condition is it's okay if these people get hurt or suffer a little if I can get my product. Like, I always try to tell everyone, a corporation isn't good or bad. It's just there to make money. And if they can outsource their stuff to Mexico, or they can outsource their stuff to China, or they can do whatever it is, make money. And these are corporations that, you know, are affiliated with the NBA and, you know, mainstream and run commercials during the Super Bowl. If these guys can sort of engage in a behavior that is a version of what we're talking about, then you go to the place that's lawless and you have a corporation. Yeah, they're going to do it. They're going to do horrible things.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
Just as long as you get your product, you're fine with it, right? That's kind of the...
Well, as long as I get my iPhone and my cocaine, then I'm fine with it.
That's a kind of... You can say the same, you know, Kiki Camarena, you know, he was passionate about his job. He did what he did, and he worked... That was a very dangerous job. I wouldn't do it. He went down there and did that job. And he got killed. He was an American. There was this whole... investigation, and now it's coming to light that the CIA might have been involved, which I'm pretty much convinced it was. But, you know, again, you go back to 68 in Mexico, 350 to 400 students were killed in a plaza that were involved in a government protest. And the CIA was feeding information to the president, who was also part of their he was on the payroll for the CIA down there. So in a way, they were also involved in that. It's the version of Tiananmen Square.
They say that was in 1968?
That's in 68 in Mexico. There's a lot of communism kind of taking root in some of the universities, and they wanted to fight back against it. But as long, you know, that's that type of stuff gets kind of like, you know, fades into the background.
Well, here's an interesting thought that I'll pose to both of you. It's interesting that we need sort of political will, like stuff gets solved. You know, politicians don't inherently care more about pollution or border security or really welfare or anything. It's just once there's a movement to clean up the river, then the politicians go, oh, yeah, yeah, I'm definitely down with clean up the river. If you don't believe me, every politician who's 75 now, when they were 60, they were like, gay marriage? What? No way. That's weird. And now they're like, what do you mean? I'm down with gay marriage. Like, well, you just change that much from age 60 to age 70? Like, and what do we have to look forward to when we're 60? But my point is I'm for gay marriage. I'm just saying, here's how politicians roll. They're against it until they're for it. And political will is an important thing. So the question I'm going to pose is, most of the folks we're dealing with, certainly in California and some of these border cities and towns, they hate Trump. And Trump has tried to demonize Mexico, meaning Mexico, scary, build a wall. So he's doing his political will, which is, hey, we got to build a wall because these scary rapists and drug dealers and stuff, we got to keep them from coming in here. CNN hears that message and go, wait a minute, these are all noble people who just want to make a living and want to feed their family. So now, and the same thing happened with China. Trump won Wuhan virus, these Chinese, they brought, and then CNN went, what do you mean, leave these Chinese alone? These are good, noble people. They're not trying to do anything. Leave them alone. This is your fault. So he essentially, if you're China or your Mexico, you got to go, oh, this is awesome, because all Trump does is call them out, and then CNN rushes in and goes, there's nothing to see here. That's not the issue. We need to see his tax returns. So his Mexico caught a break in a weird way with Trump, because I watch the news all day, every day. I don't hear word one about anything that's going on in Mexico. You could kill a bus full of Mormons over there. It wouldn't matter. It's like, oh, yeah, who cares? Now they're fine. There's nothing going on. They're actually defending China and defending Mexico because they're doing a kind of reverse engineering of what Trump wants. Does that ring true, or is that my theory?
Well, I think it's like we're at a moment of kind of system failure, right? A systemic failure. And it's like this doesn't come down to one person or one president or one institution or even one country. It's that the way the system is built right now is broken. It's a kind of institutional failure on it, whether that's, you know, American border policy or Mexico-U.S. relations. And in a weird way, you know, this documentary series is shedding a light on a moment of system failure. You can call it a failure of policing. You can call it a failure of the spy game. You know, you can call it a moment when the war on communism trumps the war on drugs. But like, that's what happened. And I think, you know, that's what we're reckoning with, is we're sort of at a moment of like system failure. So everybody's screaming and nobody's listening.
Eduardo.
Exxon Valdez and the ocean, and you go up and clean that up, and the same thing happened. It was a not an ecological disaster, but it was a foreign policy disaster happening in Mexico. You know, everybody says like, oh, so you're blaming it all on the U.S. No. It's a regional problem. The United States is part of the, you know, it's a part of a continent, and it's a regional problem. Mexico has its own problems that are systemic, related to its political class, some of the old money there, some of the it's cultural, you know. And when I heard Trump kind of play the whole, I have a Muslim friend, and he tapped me on the back when Trump won and says, it's your guys' turn to be the bad guys, right? And it was, you know, it was funny. You know, I took it with a little bit of laughing. There's problems on both sides. I'm fascinated by the news, how they basically – anything that he says is good is bad, and anything he says is bad is good. And it's just from a completely outsider perspective, I'm just scratching my head how polarized it is.
Well, I, as a guy who grew up and has been in California my whole life, there was stories coming out of Mexico, and they weren't good stories, and they weren't all day, every day, but it would happen. It would happen. And ever since Trump decided that we should build a wall, then the whole, the migrants turned into peaceful moms marching with their whatever. I think Ed knows a little more of the truth about that.
They were not peaceful.
But there's no political will, because it's not being created by the news outlets.
And it's a blackout. It's a weird blackout of information coming out of there, or anything that he touches ceases to be news.
It's also interesting that in a world where we've sort of racialized everything, that we don't have issues with Canada because they're basically white people. But if you're going to start saying something about Mexico, now there's going to be a racial component. And nobody wants to get near a racial component, no politician for sure, and news outlets as well, unless they're calling someone else a racist. But they don't want the finger pointed back at them. So maybe between those two elements, it's kind of radio silence on Mexico. It's an interesting thing in that we share a very long border with them. They're basically a narco state. There's plenty to discuss in terms of the future and the news and the border, and it literally doesn't come up. I watch the news all day, every day. It's like there's no – and it's been that way for a number of years. It just doesn't happen. It doesn't exist.
Yeah, and this documentary kind of talks a little bit about the origins of that. And the way things are right now, you live next to – like, and people debate you on this side of the border. Like, I've been debated – that Mexico isn't a failed narco state. And I tell them, okay, fly a helicopter over Sinaloa. Fly a military helicopter over Sinaloa if you can. There's no way.
They'll get shot down?
They have air superiority. Narcos have air superiority.
Is that Chinese or Russian stuff?
Some of it is American. Some of the stuff that I've seen is American, coming up from Central America. Some of the stuff that was bought with some of the money made from selling drugs back in the whatever this documentary kind of talks about. Some of those weapons are coming back up. So you see some 80s and 90s era military stuff, great stuff. Also from Africa now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mexico just found a large load of fentanyl that was trying to be put into Mexico coming from Spain out of all places.
Really?
So you would say, why Spain? Well, Chinese influence is all over the African continent, so it would make sense that they saw that you were closing up the borders and kind of tightened security on the Pacific side. So now they're moving to Atlantic through Africa.
Hey, Tiller, what else you got cooking? Because I know as a guy who makes documentaries, you have to have sort of one in the oven and one on the table and one, you know, waiting for the yeast to rise.
You gotta be locked and loaded. I got a couple of things that are coming up as well. I've got a feature film, a movie that Lionsgate is releasing that's also about the drug war. In some sense, it's a contemporary story called Silk Road, you know, about the sort of Amazon of the drug world. And that's going to be released at the end of this year or beginning of next. And then I've got a Netflix series that'll be coming out in the beginning of mid-January, I guess. It's another kind of notorious murder story that actually also takes place in 1985.
I'll give a plug. The four-part docuseries, The Last Narc, and it's available on Amazon Prime as we speak. Tiller Russell, I'll invite you back for when your other projects come out as well, because it's an interesting conversation. We'll say goodbye to Tiller for now, and Ed, I'll talk a little more about Mexico with in general. And thanks, Tiller.
Thank you so much for having me. Take care. Stay safe, guys.
We shall, and thank you. All right, let me hit True Niagen here. I've been taking cellular health vitamin True Niagen for a few months, well, more like 6 or 8 months now. As we get older, our bodies experience a near 50% decline in NAD, which negatively affects your health and the cells of your health, and your body's made up of those cells. Dr. Drew has been on True Niagen for a couple of years now, and he did say to me, he thinks that's part of the reason why he looks and feels so good. There's stressors in life, and like lack of sleep, and stressors on your immune system, overeating, and drinking too much, and all that. They all deplete NAD. So you need to take True Niagen to protect you from that depletion. Backed by Nobel Prize winning scientists, clinical research, and global regulatory approvals, and support cellular energy and cellular defense. Do it now at TrueNiagen.com. That's TrueNiagen.com. Use the code Adam. Get $20 off any 3-month supply. It's inexpensive and it's effective. So Ed, really, literally like AK-AK guns if you fly a helicopter over their poppy field?
There's the capital of Sinaloa, Culiacan. Where they captured the military captured the son, one of El Chapo's sons, and the whole of the cartel basically went in there and took him back and fought off the military, fought off the federal police and the state police. That is their territory. You can go down there and you'll see a military convoy roll around. They recently killed a high-level cartel guy, and there's a cemetery there called Jardines del Umaya. Jardines del Umaya Cemetery is basically, if you go there, you won't realize it's a cemetery. It looks like a bunch of luxury apartments next to each other. They buried recently a high level cartel guy there, and armed people being security all around that cemetery. It's not a secret cemetery. It's not some everybody knew it was going to be buried there. And there's no military presence. The government didn't crack down on all these armed men walking around with AK-47s. So they own Sinaloa. There's just no ifs, ands, or buts about it. That state and that city is theirs, right? So when people argue, no, Mexico isn't a narco state, in some parts the narcos own the states they work in.
What would it be the equivalent of here? Would it be the equivalent? Like there was CHOP in Seattle, right?
Chaz
and CHOP. They took over 3 blocks.
Yeah.
Would it be like a group owning all of Seattle, or what would be it's a little apples to oranges, but if you could kind of draw an equivalent, what would that be like?
I'll go over how they control things, and you would have to kind of. So imagine that you had a criminal group that paid for every single successful run on the governorship of California.
Right.
imagine there was a criminal group that paid for the campaigns of both governors, and they would always win. So they would own the state from the governor on down.
I think we'd still do better than Newsom. I do. Don't you feel like if a drug cartel, like if you said to me, would you rather have Gavin Newsom or somebody that the drug cartel conjured up? I'd be like, well, he can't be worse than Newsom, right? Like, I think I could get a haircut if the guy was from the Sinaloa cartel was running, pulling the strings. I got to believe that the sports cuts would be open in La Cañada, right?
Well, you can go back a little bit and in Sinaloa, the people that were actually enforcing the quarantine were the cartel guys.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's a push.
So they would call out to anybody that wants to buy drugs. Stay at home. We're going to deliver. If you want women, stay at home. We're going to deliver. And if we catch anybody without a mask outside, you're going to get the board, which is basically a long wooden board that they use to punish criminals down there.
So, how do they use that?
They handcuff you behind your back. They put they put you in a half Nelson. They pull down your pants and then they grab that board and just go to town.
Wasn't there a clip of that on the internet?
There's a clip of that. That is a classic correctional device in Mexico, not just for cartels, but for all sorts of weird youth out there.
So that video I saw on Twitter, I don't know, did you send it out?
I did not send that out. It's out there. There's a few out there of cartels basically policing their towns, and the people down there don't call the cops. They call the cartels.
And they give them the board.
If you're lucky. Or else you'll end up in a bag.
Oh, wait a minute. It's quite the opposite of what I was saying. Max Pata has an article on CNN that talk about women moving to Mexico after the George Floyd situation. So I guess it's more dangerous here than in Mexico. What part
of Mexico are they moving to?
Well, this particular one in the article moved to Puerto Vallarta. But yeah, she packed her bags, quit her job in law enforcement, and moved to Mexico after George Floyd's death. It's a phenomenon dubbed as Blacksit.
Yeah, so Puerto Vallarta is safe because it's run by a single cartel.
So there's just a one cartel, not feuding cartels?
Yeah.
So she's moving to one cartel town.
She's one of many African-Americans leaving the United States permanently for many reasons, including racism and fear of police brutality.
Do they have racism in Mexico?
Yes. We are the most...
Wait, we invented racism.
No. We still have blackface comedy on TV.
But we invented racism.
No. Mexicans are...
These are noble, hardworking, family-oriented, God-fearing people who just want a better life.
Okay, I grew up reading a magazine and still on newsstands called Memín Pingüín. It's basically a black kid, and it's pretty racist.
But Ed, I like you, and I know you think you know about Mexico. We invented racism. Now, some of it may have slipped past the border and made its way into Tijuana.
Yeah, okay. Okay?
But we invented racism, and when it comes to bad cops, that's another thing we do. We have racist cops who are bad cops who then take it out on the citizens, and that's why these black ladies have to move to the single cartel town.
I don't see that. I mean, she could move to a place like Guanajuato where there's two cartels feuding and then say, well, it's great that there's no, the police here are great, they're not corrupt. So I moved away from the U.S. because of police corruption and violence. I mean, that doesn't.
But CNN says that this is a big deal, that these people are trying to escape. So we have persecution here. Okay. Listen. We take citizens, and if they don't look like us, you know what I mean? Like they're not blonde haired and blue eyed, then we go after them because we have systemic racism in this country. And in Mexico, you have a group of super hardworking, family oriented people who want a better life. So if you're here and you're a woman, and especially a woman of color, and you don't want a target on your back, then you move to Mexico where it's safe.
No.
But please listen. that's why you moved to Mexico, for safety's sake. You want to fear for your child every time they leave the house because of the color of their skin? Would you want them to be hunted? Hunted. Literally hunted. LeBron James, who's one of our famous basketball players, explains it. They're hunting black people here. Do they have such a sport in your homeland of Mexico where they just hunt people of color? Or people that are different than them. That's our thing. We don't like people who are different than us. That you have to look like Tom Petty. Otherwise, we hunt you.
Yeah.
Didn't you watch CNN?
I've never felt hunted at all.
Meanwhile, Mexico evidently is a utopia because I watch CNN and I don't hear anything negative about Mexico. There was that group of hardworking folks that were moving toward the border through Central America and then in through Mexico. These are noble. These are kids.
You know.
These are little girls. These are little girls and their mothers who are coming to the border to seek a better life.
18th Street gang members paid to move and make a commotion and just do a media circus.
Okay, you're not watching CNN.
No.
This is a group, a proud group of people who are seeking a better life.
You don't seek a better life by going across a country – robbing and stealing your way across that country and then making demands to the government to let you in or else give you $50,000 so you can go back home. That's not how it works.
I don't know what you talk about. We took many of those young children, we threw them into cages, and then we pepper sprayed them.
Okay.
So what happened was, look, I'm not saying Donald Trump physically built the cages himself, but he may have asked the guys who were building the wall to build cages, and then they threw them in the cage, and then they pepper sprayed them.
Okay, so those cages, those detention centers, I actually visited some of those centers before the Trump administration was...
No, he invented, it was his idea to build the cages and put the kids in the cages. That didn't exist pre-Trump.
Every time somebody commits a crime in the U.S. and they have kids with them, they get separated from their kids, and every time I've seen from the Bush administration, when minors would cross the border with their parents, they would be separated from them as they were processed. And there was a detention center.
Right. That was Bush.
And then it was Obama.
Then they stopped doing it.
No, so during the Obama administration, the same thing.
Well, now you're not watching CNN. They stopped it for 8 years. And then Trump got in and kickstarted the whole program again.
No, that's.
What year were you there?
2006.
Uh-huh. Well, wait a minute. Now I got to do the goddamn math.
Time machine.
Yeah. Joe Obama wasn't in charge then.
Okay.
All right. So they were there. Okay. And then they mothballed them for those 8 years. And then Trump went over there and he did a ribbon cutting ceremony. And they reopened the cages and they started ushering the kids into the cage. Everybody looked like those crab pots. You know what I mean? You ever see Deadliest Catch? They come pulling up. It was that way. That's the way they did it. Just packed in there, and they pepper spray them when they're not sexually assaulting them.
The largest amount of children coming through the border was during the Obama administration. I was active back then. I saw them being sometimes bused into the close to the border and then crossed. A lot of these kids actually made it through the whole of the country. I have some horrible stories out of them. Some of them disappearing during their crossing, but that was mostly during the Obama administration.
But can you see why the black women want to move from Minnesota to Mexico for their safety?
I mean, Puerto Vallarta is a resort town. I mean, that's not a hotbed of cartel activity as far as murders and two groups fighting.
Well, Eduardo, they had to resort to leaving because they didn't want to be hunted by their own police force.
Well, I know a little bit about being hunted, and I actually came to this country running from some of that stuff down there, so I have no idea what's going through her head.
Right, but you're not a minority. We hunt minorities in this country, so you've got to watch the news.
I'm kind of... I got a little bit of tan.
I do love the theme of that, about our racist society never end. Like, we never stop. We ratchet it up. We go nuts every 10 minutes. Like, we're now... We had 8 years of a black president, and we're upping our racist argument about this country 10,000-fold in the last 20 minutes.
And, I mean, Mexico, I mean, it's not joking. We are very racist in Mexico. The whole I'm a Native American, I'm proud of my heritage thing up here in the U.S. is, like, fascinating to me. Because in Mexico, my grandfather was a Native American, and he wouldn't talk about it. It was a thing to be ashamed of down there.
So yeah, explain that. Explain Native American as it pertains to Mexico.
So if you're brown and very ethnic in Mexico, you're an Indio, and that's a derogatory term.
Right.
There's experiments done with children where some of the browner children, more on the Native side, they get a white Barbie and a brown Barbie, and they ask them which one is the evil one, and they will always grab the brown one and raise it. This one is the evil one. And it's a systemic cultural thing that's programmed. All of our telenovelas, all the heroes are blonde. All of the ladies on the news usually are Caucasians, and we have this weird cultural fascination with Caucasians on novellas and as heroes and stuff like that.
So it's like in India, they have the whole skin lightening cream world where, like, the dark Indians are not desirable and the light Indians – that's why I love it. It's like we invented racism. You don't think these cultures have been around for – couple of minutes before us? Okay. And by the way, racism and slavery, we both were the only country to engage in slavery. I do love that. So you growing up, so you're darker, which means you have more Indian in your heritage.
Yeah. Yeah.
What we would call Native American or whatever.
Yeah. Down here in Mexico, they call it prieto. You're brown. It's like a derogatory term. Prieto.
Right. And so people can see that on you.
Yeah.
And they treat you differently.
Yes. Yes. So if you're not light skinned, and if you have like green eyes or blue eyes down there, you're like, you get like, it's like a lifetime free pass of things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's weird. And people here that are hearing this that are Mexican will, you know, they're probably nodding in agreement out there.
How are you treated in this country, or what has been your experience in terms of your nationality?
I travel every weekend to a different state. I was in Cleveland last weekend. And then depending on where I am, I'm treated as an exotic person, which is pretty fascinating that I'm exotic to them. California always treats me with, you're from Mexico? Yeah. Can I speak Spanish then? Like they try to accommodate me, so they switch to Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Like Cory Booker in the remember that when he spoke, he was pandering,
right?
It was horrible. Like as a native speaker, I was like,
pandering.
Can you please stop?
Yes,
spandering.
But have you been treated with any negativity in this country solely because of your ethnicity?
And yes, and it's usually from Chicanos or Mexicans.
Why? What is their beef?
The worst enemy of Mexican is another Mexican. That's just the cultural thing. We don't like ourselves. That's apparently the thing. But as far as Americans, Filipino Americans, Native Americans, all that, I've never experienced any sort of racism or any sort of you can't be here or we don't like your kind here. Outside of a few movies, I've never actually experienced that. You know.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I kind of feel the way with racism as I do with COVID-19, which is like people go, how do you deny this person their experience or that person that experience? And I go, I don't. And I'm not looking at FBI crime statistics or anything. But I've been on this goddamn planet for 56 years, and I've known people of all different origins, and there's just not been an issue.
Yeah.
And it's the same with the COVID-19 in that – I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm saying I don't know anyone who's been killed by it. Okay. I know I've talked to Bean Baxter from Kevin and Bean. He got it. It was like getting the flu. I talked to Bryan Cranston the other week. He and his wife got it. They didn't know they had it. I've talked to different people who have had it, and I've not talked to anyone who's been killed by it, which is but here's what I'm equating it to with racism, which is I'm not saying it doesn't exist. It absolutely exists. Everything exists. I'm saying we shouldn't lock down and cower under our bed in a fetal position, because it's the same with racism, which is like, it exists. I don't know anyone who's a racist, and I don't know one who's been the subject of racism. And so for that reason, I'm going to live my life.
It's like the talk of about slavery, the historical slavery in this country, and how people speak of it in the past tense. You have African Americans talking about reparations and stuff like that. You actually have slavery right now. Indentured slaves coming into this country illegally and working off their ability to stay here.
Is that mainly from China?
It's from all over.
Are the East mainly, or
it's
all over?
It's Mexicans go through some of this process where they're brought here illegally and they have to work off their ability to stay here. Sex trafficking, women coming in from all around the East Coast, coming in from Eastern Europe, that I've seen, you know, that I've kind of studied into.
How much is sex trafficking a thing? And I don't mean to be that broad, but I mean, it's like, I walk through the airports of this country, I see the signs up, you know, sex trafficking and human trafficking, and I always kind of think to myself, is there that much of that going on? And if so, where is it? And I get it's not in La Cañada, California, and, you know, in my neighborhood, but I mean, like, I travel, I watch the news, I feel like I see things, like, where is it and how does it work?
The most of the stuff that I experienced as far as sex trafficking happened in Mexico, and a lot of it happened on the border.
Hold on, Ed. Sorry. These are noble, hardworking, God-fearing people who just want a better life for their kids. So I don't know where the sex trafficking thing is.
Well, it's behind drug smuggling and guns, it's the biggest moneymaker for criminal groups in Mexico. Trafficking in people.
But that's because we've created a market for sex trafficking. We have a lot of horny, red-haired Americans who want to have sex with underage Latina women. And so that wouldn't exist if we didn't create the market for it.
That, and you like eating salads during a COVID epidemic. And apparently, you know, slave labor is allowed during – they're essential workers, you know?
That's really? You mean pickers?
Yeah. Pickers were essential workers during the COVID epidemic. There was no shortages of salads in the supermarkets.
Can you help me with this? It's always confusing to me when our politicians say, and I'm not saying there's a math that I can't do, but they always go, we can't get white people to do these jobs, or we can't get Americans to do these jobs.
You can't get Americans to do those jobs.
And but my thing is, if you pay them, you can. Like, I used to do work. So here's the deal. I grew up in Los Angeles, and you know what was very popular in Los Angeles? You even see in old TV shows and movies and stuff like that, Japanese gardeners.
Okay.
They didn't have Mexican gardeners. They had Japanese gardeners.
Yeah.
That was a thing. It was not only that, but as much as sort of the Mexican with the leaf blower and whatever – it was, if you want to run back to the 60s and even the 70s and even into the 80s, it was a Japanese gardener.
It's Miyagi.
So, Mr. Miyagi. That shit took place in Tarzana or something. That's the middle of the San Fernando Valley. And Mr. Miyagi was a Japanese gardener. That movie was made in the 80s, but he was an older guy who was a gardener. And was he a school maintenance guy and a gardener or just gardener? The point is, trust me, all Japanese gardeners.
Okay.
My family was poor, and even my grandparents, who were like a little less poor, had a Japanese gardener, which is – now, imagine a Japanese gardener in Los Angeles today. It seems –
exotic.
It seems exotic.
Exotic. Something very expensive probably.
And it seems exotic and unthinkable, but it was something that happened. So my feeling is – when I used to clean carpets, it's a demographic thing, but I cleaned it with Chris Bohm, it's like a German guy, a Ray Oldhofer, German guy, a Todd Euler, Jewish guy. There was a Willie Calderon. Willie Maldonado. He was he may have been Italian and Mexican, whatever. But the point is, it's just a bunch of white people doing carpet cleaning work, you know, real shit work. And I when I got out of high school, I went on a construction site. I worked as a laborer. So did all these other guys. Every guy I knew worked labor. Now, you kind of go, well, you're not going to get Americans to do that, or you're not going to get white guys to do that. Well, you get poor people to do a lot of shit.
Yeah, you flood the market with cheap labor.
Well, you won't.
That right. Don't complain about anything. They're just going to keep you quiet. No.
But what I'm saying is if you said, we're not going to flood the market, we're going to hire Americans to do this, we're going to have to pay them $17 an hour, they're not going to do it for $9 an hour, and then they'd go, well, the cost of lettuce, I mean, the cost of your wedge salad's going to go up. But my argument to that is sort of like saying, well, then that's the cost of lettuce. Like, if you say, I want a car, they go, well, it's going to be $3,000 worth of airbags in that car. And you can't go, I don't want it. You can just go, that's what's in a new car. Well, it's airbags.
Yeah, right now you're seeing China's the bad guy, and you make a lot of stuff in China, and you have a country that is, you can manufacture a lot of stuff down there. You have a lot of cheap labor up here that comes from Mexico. You're in weird, as a country, you're in denial of your one. There's jobs that Americans don't want to do. And it's interesting that whole concept of jobs that Americans don't want to do.
No,
you're onto something when you say they don't want to do them because they don't want to get paid the wages that the basically indentured servant slaves are being paid in those fields. They're being paid not minimum wage. That's all I'm going
to
say.
I don't, you know, it's sad to me. Well, a couple things. One is like when the politician, especially the Democratic politician, goes, oh, you want to pay $5 for a head of lettuce? It's like, buddy, I'm going to pay whatever is a fair wage. I don't want you to pay these people less than minimum wage or living wage. But also when you travel and you go to like West Virginia and you walk out of your hotel room, there's a blonde chick pushing a vacuum cleaner in the hall. You're like, what's going on? And you're like,
I had a moment like that in Wisconsin. Oh, hi, how are you? Red hair, older lady, white. That was pretty fascinating at a hotel.
I'm always thinking of like Days of Thunder, where they sent the prostitute over dressed as a cop. I'm like, okay, baby, how does this work? She's like, I work at the fucking hotel. Yeah, okay, I bet you, let me take my pants off here. Because you never see that here, like especially in California. You would never see it. But what I'm saying is somewhere in Wisconsin and Virginia, they do have blonde people and red-haired people doing jobs that you think they won't do.
Yeah.
You just have to pay them.
You have to pay them. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there has to be some sort of mid-ground solution to this where they used to have programs called the Bracero programs where you would have people coming in on work visas and just work and then go back. And, you know, that worked for a while. Somewhere along the lines, things got corrupted in such a way where, you know, I imagine some of the major companies out there. I think the governor has a winery up there, which was not open for business.
Oh yeah, you know? Gotta keep it open. People need to drink,
but
you don't need to get your hair cut.
And I actually know a few of the people that work in some of his fields, and I know that they are irregular, and they
what's irregular?
They don't have any paperwork.
Which is
fine. Most of the people working in Napa Valley in those fields, that's what makes it run.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting thing about it is they were open for public events even during the whole close down portion. That's what they told me. And that they were essential, basically. That's what they were told. Maybe jokingly, but that's what they were told.
I've asked before, with no end in sight for Mexico, as far as what I can tell, what would be the best thing for Mexico? What we've talked in the past about you probably thinking that basically the United States annexing them would probably be the best, but I don't know. I can't recall.
It's not that they're going to annex Mexico. I think you guys need to annex California first. I personally think there's going to be some sort of armed intervention in Mexico by the U.S.
You do.
And it's going to be related to resources, not drugs or violence. As a country, and you can see this in Africa happening, a lot of Chinese mining companies out there competing directly with Western governments.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're going to run into a case where the U.S. is going to need all that lithium right across the border.
As we get into the battery, electric, everything?
I think you're already starting to see that. I think that's going to lead to an intervention of some sort in Mexico. Main problem I see with that scenario is the government and the cartels are basically two heads on a snake. They are in a lot of ways are intertwined. The people down there are sick of the government, and they're also a lot of them are sick of the cartels. So any sort of intervention down there, leads me into kind of the scenario where you went into Iraq and eliminated the government, you disbanded the military on one side and supported other ethnicities on the other, and basically led to this internal war or civil war.
Well, it's interesting. You're uniquely qualified to answer this, which is we make the mistake as the United States in grafting on our wishes and desires onto every other nation.
Yeah.
So we go, in the Middle East, they want freedom. They love freedom. Everyone loves freedom. They want freedom. And so we go over there and we go, once we show them a little glimpse of freedom, then they're going to grab onto it with both hands and embrace it, you know. And what you learn is certain cultures don't want the same thing we want. So this thing of like, we're going to go to Mexico, we're going to liberate these people, and they're going to rise up and be free. I don't know. Maybe that's not their culture. And then one could argue, I don't think it is their culture, because how did this happen in the first place? Yeah. Like in the Middle East, as an example, things have to take place. Like shit has to go down. And what I mean is like, there's a reason why this group is governed this way. There's a reason why cartels have taken over there. There's a reason why there's warlords in Africa. It's because there's something in the people that tolerated, accepted, or in some cases needed or wanted in its own perverse way. So maybe this notion of going to a place where this is and going, oh, good, we're going to let you, we treat it like someone is wrongfully accused and put in jail, and we're just going to open the door, and they're going to go, oh, freedom, escape. They'll go back and spend the night in the cell.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it feels like in the Middle East, and that's a miscalculation on our part.
Yeah, I mean, a micro example of that is Tijuana, the one of the most violent cities in the world currently. It was pacified during some of the time that it was active. It was the numbers went all the way down. It ceased to be on that world's most dangerous list. Public was very like, we don't want any more cartel music being played live. We're sick of it. Thank you for the military. Thank you to the police for bringing peace to the city. And everybody forgot about it, and we're back to having these big, cartel bands playing in some of the places down there. And narco culture is being embraced by most of the youth.
Yeah.
And Netflix has something to do with it. Narcos, Mexico has something to do with it. Glorifying some of that culture has something to do with it. But
I think you're going to find that's going to happen in New York City as well. We had a lot of crime, then we cleaned it all up, then we decided we hated Stop and Frisk, and now it's going to come back.
Yeah, yeah. It's cyclical.
Cyclical. All right, let me hit Simply Safe for 15 quick seconds. Nobody should feel unsafe at home, period, and that's where Simply Safe comes in. Protect your home. Do it today. Get free shipping at simplysafe.com/Adam. Well, we could go on forever, Eds, and for that reason, we'll just have you back sooner than later and keep this stuff going. Website, edsmanifesto.com is where you go, offering Zoom courses right now, and they have a new online store as well. It's got lots of goodies in there. Tiller Russell, the four-part docuseries, The Last Narc, it's available now on Prime Video. Donald Trump Jr., Liberal Privilege, available September 1st, and you can pre-order it on Amazon or pre-order it at donjr.com. I'm going to be in Tempe, Arizona at the Improv September 18th and 19th. Go to adamcarolla.com for all that you need. And until next time, this is Adam Carolla for Tiller Russell and Donald Trump Jr. and Ed Calderon and Gene Unbald saying mahalo.
Stick around. The Ace Man returns with Dave Damashek and Good Sports right after this.
Ace and Shecky, let's do it. Good Sports.
The Podcast One Sports Network presents Good Sports.
Hi and hello, sports fans. Welcome to the Thursday edition of Good Sports. As always, guaranteed to include some hot sports talk. Dave Damashek here. Adam Carolla over there. Ace, we're into week two, three-ish for these NFL teams now practicing. And one thing that stands out along with all the other massive changes is with training camp this year is the how much should we be hitting question kind of thing. Because they've kind of slow rolled and then there's no.
Oh, Sheck just locked up. I got a story that I was planning on telling until Sheck unseizes his technology. Not that it's him. It's an internet thing. Let's just stop for a second. We were talking on the last show about the now when you win Le Mans, you bring the car in, you wrap it in a clear bra, park it in the Porsche Museum. You don't wipe it down. Sheck was telling me he'd rather have a helmet from Mean Joe Green with some stick marks on it than a new helmet. And I agree. And I was just looking at it at the other shop. Oh, the internet went down on our end, so it's not a Sheck's end, but I can keep going. I was at my other shop. I was organizing some stuff, putting some stuff away, blah, blah, blah. And I came across my old game jersey from North Hollywood High, and it has the date written on it. It also has the date that Robert and Lenny, the two guys who died in the car crash, the Pinto explosion that caught on fire a couple days earlier. And it has the score, Monroe High. They beat us 14-7. And it's still got all the dirt and grass stains and everything on it. I never washed it. I always knew it would be I knew I was never going to wear it again. So I was like, why should I wash it? So I just left my last game-worn jersey from North Hollywood High, which was our white away jersey. I just left it with the stains and the scubba and the muck on it. And I'm glad I did. And like I said, it's only that way one time. Now, my car, my Porsche that won its class in Le Mans, that car went from Hawaiian Tropic to Apple Computers to like Red Roof Inn or something. It switched liveries probably six times in its career. And then you start getting into this world of, well, what would you guys do? I'll put it to Gary. I already made my move. But then you get into this world, which is I bought a Paul Newman race car that was an Oldsmobile Cutlass with Pepsi as the sponsor on it when Paul raced it back in the day. Then when I got it, it had a Camaro body on it because Paul owned the car. And somebody said to him, yeah, you don't want an Oldsmobile Cutlass body on there with Pepsi, who's not sponsoring the car anymore. You should put a cool Camaro body on it. So they put a cool Camaro body on it. And then Paul just ran it in events generically. It had no sponsorship. It was red, white, and blue, but it didn't have any corporate sponsorship on it. And then he drove it for a while as a Camaro. And then when I got it, I saved the Camaro body, but I put it back to an Oldsmobile, how it would have raced in period. But I do think about it every once in a while, and I go, Maybe I should have left the Camaro body on it, because that was how Paul drove it, as he owned it personally, but not as he drove it during the season. Gary, thoughts?
I think that you were right to put it back to the Oldsmobile. I think that's cool in the way that you did it. But I don't, you know, and maybe you can educate me here. I don't see why you can't change the liveries over the course of the time you own the cars the way they did back in the day. I'd love to see that Hawaiian Tropic Porsche 935 in the Apple livery for a year or two. You know, just to see how it is.
Yeah, true. The problem is, that's fine. The problem is the body went from a 935 to a 935 K3. So it's the body needs to change too. It's doable.
But that's a bigger endeavor.
It's bigger than vinyl, you know, vinyl appliques. It's the whole body. It's got to come off. It's not that big a deal because it's just kind of front clip, rear clip, whatever. But it's a little more. And you just, in the app, what you need to do is just build an Apple replica car to have next to it. That's what you need.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, and I'm working on that. And actually, an Apple replica 935 just sold for like $250,000, just a pure kit car. Well, I don't mean kit car, but I just mean pure ground up replica car, not a 935 with history, or not even a 935. Just,
does it have a similar power plant?
You know, the thing about Porsche is, yeah, this had a turbo Porsche engine on it, but it was like kind of a modern Porsche engine on it. But you could find any different configuration of Porsche power plants, carbureted or turbocharged. I don't think there's such a thing as a supercharged rear engine air-cooled Porsche, but you wouldn't really see it, so you could do a kind of replica car and power it just about any way you wanted to power it. I'm going to build a couple of supercars that way. I've always sort of had it in my mind to do it. Sheck is trying to power back on here, but oh, there he is. Sheck, you sound off when you can hear me.
Oh, there he is. All right.
There he is. So we left off.
I was just throwing to you. I just threw. Oh, I don't know where I cut off. I was just asking you about if you think hitting is important.
Oh, hitting. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. So at the beginning of your career, you know, playing Pop Warner football, hitting is such an unnatural thing, you know, and you have to really coach kids to hit and not to kind of turn. You want to kind of turn away as you're hitting. And so they would do all these insane drills, just, you know, bull in the ring. And I just remember one very specifically, which was just this kind of 90 degree drill, which is our coaches would go to the sideline, and, you know, the sideline would run north and south, and then east and west would be the lines running across the field, you know, and they just line half the team up 10 yards back from where the sideline met the line that was going across the field, the yard marker line, and the other half of the team just be 10 yards back, and there was just the intersection, and they just run it like they were testing side impact on a car. You know what I mean? Like we're just running and just run a barrel of weight into the side to see how it affected the driver's side or whatever. And they just collide. And the deal was, if you backed off or turned or slowed up or tried to dodge the guy, you were doing laps. That's how they worked it. So they just ran 9-year-olds into each other. That's essentially how they did it.
Shaming the lack of physicality out of you, basically.
Right. And they just, and the whole team would just watch. You know what I mean? If you did a move where you did a little fancy footwork right before you got to the guy, or turned or stopped, you just had to run a lap. So they beat that out of you early. And I remember when I got to high school, there were a couple guys who were athletic guys, but clearly didn't really play any Pop Warner, and they were having difficulty with squaring up and hitting somebody. They had all those tendencies. Now, once you get to the pros, you've done such such an ample amount of hitting other guys, you don't really need that technique. I you know, it may sound like I'm flying in my own argument here, but it's all technique. It's all strategy at that point. When the game starts, there'll be plenty of hitting to do. I don't know that those guys need to practice hitting.
I'm inclined to agree with that. Yeah, that at some point in your career but that rings true that guys who are super fast don't necessarily translate to being football players. I guess it is the difference of like, I know all the answers. I'm watching Jeopardy from the comfort of my couch. I know all the answers. But when you add in the layer of the white hot lights, that makes it harder. Like, yeah, I can run super fast. I can outrun anybody. Yeah, how about if somebody's trying to push you while you're doing it? Then that changes things. Ron Brown couldn't do it for the Rams. Ronaldo Nehemiah couldn't really make it for the 49ers. More guys fail. Maybe that's why Usain Bolt couldn't do it. A lot of NFL guys have told me that, because I always like to, they get very upset when you claim you could do it. I always say, like, if you gave me the best offense in the NFL and put me under center, I could drive that team to a field goal at least. And they say, if you ever got hit once by a football player, it would either kill you or would break your will to ever do it again. I question that. I wouldn't want to get hit by Mike Tyson in his prime. I'd be all right if, Von Miller hit me from behind once. I'd survive that. And then I'd get up and my helmet would be sideways, but then I'd pull it straight and I'd rally the team, earning the respect of my teammates and then leading them to that aforementioned field goal.
There's no doubt. All right.
Thank you.
Let me hit Bet Online here. No shortage of action, especially if our exclusive partner, betonline.ag. MLB's up in full swing. NBA, they're in the bubble and they're playing. Man, what's his name? I was watching
Dame Lillard.
Dame Lillard. That guy was
Dame so Lillard is making 40-foot shots on purpose. It's crazy.
Incredible. Bet Online has best odds and lines for upcoming games and matches. NASCAR, soccer, UFC, whatever, boxing, that's all going. Need more? Bet Online has simulated NFL, NBA, and UFC daily. Also, hundreds of live casino games, poker tournaments, best props in the business. Visit betonline.ag. It's our exclusive partner at Podcast One. And don't forget, use the promo code Podcast One for your sign-up bonus today. Bet Online, your online sportsbook experts.
Dynamite closing out the week with good sports for you tomorrow. Until then, for Adam Carolla, Dave Damashek, good sports out. Good sports.
Follow the Adam Carolla Show on Twitter at Adam Carolla Show. Follow Ace on Twitter at Adam Carolla. You can leave us a voicemail at 888-634-1744. And be sure and pick up Adam's book, I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. It's available everywhere. Get the links at adamcarolla.com.